I have a dream. One small step.
Oh, my, we say.
The wall must go.
China, Princess of Wales.
Right into the World Trade Center.
Winner is Sydney.
This week in history.
If you know that music, you will know a bit about our story tonight. It is the music from the film The Great Escape. And tonight, for this week in history, the real Great Escape, the breakout from Stalag Luft III prisoner of war camp on March 24th, 1944, which later became the basis for a famous Hollywood film starring Steve McQueen and Richard Attenborough. Today is, in fact, the 75th anniversary of this event. 76 prisoners of war escaped through a long tunnel out of the camp, and it was also one of the great tragedies of World War II, as the majority of the men involved were executed by the Gestapo. Only three made it to freedom. Five Australians were among those shot dead, and another Australian, the journalist Paul Brickhill, who was in the camp, made the story famous by writing the book The Great Escape in 1950. His biographer is Australian Stephen Dando Collins, and he's our guest for this week in history. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Sarah. Great to be with you tonight.
Yes, let's unpack the reality of this versus the film tonight, because you know we know it too much from that. So let's hear what we know to be fact. Take us back to World War II to start with, Poland. What was the camp like, and who was sent there?
Okay, so it's a town called Sagan. And it's in Silesia. And at that time, 1943-44, it was part of Germany. After the war, Poland was given Silesia. So since the war, it's been part of Poland. This camp was called, as you say, Stalag Luft III. And it was a large camp for Allied airmen shot down and captured by the Germans. And at its height, it had 11,000 Allied prisoners in there. It was not the only camp. There were scores of POW camps across Germany and Poland through the war. But this was the camp where they concentrated the officers and non-commissioned ranks mostly from the Royal Air Force and also from the United States Army Air Force. But of course, included in the Royal Air Force were a number of Americans who'd enlisted in the RAF, Australians, dozens of Australians. They were actually, most of them were members of the Royal Australian Air Force, but they were seconded to the British to help Britain. New Zealanders, Canadians, South Africans, Dutch, Czechs, Norwegians, Danes, Poles, Belgians, French, Greeks, even an Argentinian. But they all had the common factor that they were flying for the RAF.
And how many would have been there at the time of the Great Escape? You said 1,100 at the peak. What about during the escape?
So the camp, it was 11,000 at its peak.
Oh, sorry, 11,000.
11,000.
Okay.
But it was split into four sections. And at the time that Paul Brickhill arrived at the camp on April 4th, 1943, they'd just opened this new camp, a new compound, North Camp compound, and they'd moved most of the Brits and other British airmen into that camp, and there were 1,200 in there. Now, of those, half were involved in the escape or preparations for the escape. The other half wanted nothing to do with it. Some said, "You're crazy. The Germans have warned us that you'll be shot if you try to get out." Others were having a lovely time. They found themselves in the camp and they had great camp theatre going. And so they were really enjoying themselves.
What, they weren't surely not having too much fun to escape, really?
Absolutely. And there were men there who had aspirations to go on the stage before the war, and they were writing and producing these shows, musical shows, song and dance, which kept the men occupied and entertained. But they had no interest in the escape whatsoever.
Were conditions better at this camp than many others because
Absolutely.
They were Because they were officers?
Because they were officers, and the Geneva Convention allowed them certain freedoms that weren't allowed to some other prisoners. For example, the Russians never signed the Geneva Convention in 1929. The Germans did. So the Germans recognised the rights of the British officers not to be forced to work and various other rights. And they did this because they knew the British would recognise the same, give the same rights to German prisoners in British camps. So life wasn't too bad. The worst part, Paul Brickhill said, is that you never knew when it was going to end, if it would ever end. You know, where are we going to be here for life? Mm. It was an endless sentence with no light at the end of the tunnel. And it was boring. You know, they could play sports. A lot of us got involved in various sports. There were some who were so bored silly that they got involved in the escape. Wings Day, who was one of the leaders of the escape, in the ex-organisation, as they called it, said only about 5% of the prisoners were really intent on escaping. The other 600 were virtually ordered to be involved in various ways. But Paul Brickhill was very much involved in the early stages of the escape and was very enthusiastic. He was bored silly as well. So a lot of them did it just for something to do. Ultimately, 220 were put on the escape list. And as you mentioned, I think 76 got out.
Yeah. All right. So Stalag Luft had already been home to a rather ingenious escape before involving a wooden horse. Just briefly tell us that before we get to the Great Escape.
Okay, so in East Compound, there were a number of British airmen, including two, Eric Williams and Michael Codner, both Brits, who'd been in a previous escape from a camp at a place called Shubin. And Shubin was where a lot of the great escapers did their apprenticeship in escaping and tunnelling. They invented the ex-organisation there, and all the different departments, those that made fake turned the uniforms into civilian clothing, fake documents and all this. They pioneered this at this place called Shubin, which was about 200 kilometres further to the east in Poland. 34 of them got out in March 1943, and all but two were pretty soon recaptured, two drowned trying to paddle to Sweden. So they were all sent to Stalag Luft III. So they'd all had plenty of practice, and they became the core of the escape organisation, which came to be headed by a guy called Roger Bushell. Roger hadn't been in those earlier escapes. He'd only arrived at the camp at Stalag Luft III fairly late in March 1943. But he was a dedicated escaper. He'd been trying to escape from other camps for quite some time. And he was put in charge. They called him Big X. And they assigned various duties to various members of the escape committee. And Paul Brickhill, the Australian, being an enthusiast, became one of the diggers digging the tunnels. So Bushell had decided we're going to dig three tunnels.
So that was Bushell's idea, Big X's idea, tunnels.
Three tunnels at once, and we're going to get every man in the compound out.
That
was his original plan, to get all 1,200 prisoners out. So the Germans soon, they were called Tom, Dick and Harry. Tom was soon discovered by the Germans and filled in. Harry was the one that they continued digging after Dick was making good progress, but then the Germans started to clear the ground on the other side of the wire where it was intended for it to come out to create yet another compound. So they gave up on Dick, and they started to use that to dispose of dirt from Harry. So We end up with one tunnel called Harry, and it's going to have to go 100 metres under various buildings, under the wire, out to the forest on the other side.
Right. And how did they organise the dig of Harry?
Various men were assigned digging duty. There was a guy called Wally Floody. He was a Canadian, and he told Roger Bushell that he'd been in the mining game in Canada before the war. So Bushell thought he meant he was an educated and experienced engineer. He'd been a gold panner, basically. But he didn't tell Bushell that. But it turned out he was a very good engineer. And he came up with the idea of how and when they would do it. And the topsoil was very sandy, and so if you tried to dig a tunnel through that, it just would cave in. And also the Germans had become quite sophisticated in their anti-escape detection activities, and they had sound detection devices down to several feet in the earth. So Floody said, we're going to have to go down to 30 foot, or about 9 metres, before we start digging straight towards the forest. So they went. And the other problem was that the Germans, to stop tunnelling, had built all the huts 2 foot or 60 centimetres above ground.
And so how did they begin then? How did they even start the tunnel?
Exactly. Fortunately, in hut 104, every hut had a central stove for heating hot water and keeping the place warm. And that was built on solid concrete, which went down to the earth. So what Floody said, well, let's see what happens if we pull the stove off. So they pulled the stove off the concrete base, concrete and brick, and they actually chipped down through that to the earth. Through the concrete. It took months. And they would sing or have music or whatever going on in the hut to disguise the sound of the chipping. And they got through that to the sand below. And through that gap, which was just wide enough for a man to go down, your shoulders touching the side, then they started digging down from that. And they, initially they created a small house, if you like, underground cave as their starting point and workshop. And from that, they then started digging the tunnel, which, as I mentioned earlier, was 100 metres long, but only 45 centimetres or 2 foot wide.
That's skinny.
Isn't that skinny? Yeah. And a little higher. Now, yeah. Paul Bricker was one of the tunnellers, put his hands up to be a tunneller. And they said, okay, down you go. And the first time he went down, he found for the first time in his life, he's only early 30s, that he suffered from claustrophobia. And absolutely panicked. Get me out.
So that's why he never actually escaped.
He up to that point, he'd been high on the list for escape. Yeah. They wrote down the names of who was going to go out. And those with the best chance were given early priority, and he was at about number 12 or something. Mm. And they said, well, sorry about that. But even then they left him on the list because he then became boss of the stooges, as they were called, the guards who kept watch, looking out for the German ferrets, as they were called. And they were guarding the forges. So he was a security officer, if you
like. Right, okay.
So he's still very much involved.
But, important.
But in the last weeks, Roger Bushell takes him aside and he said, four or five of you guys had claustrophobia when you went down and try and dig. We can't run the risk of that happening on the night that we go out. If you panic, you might bring the whole thing down, you'll slow it down. So you're off the list.
No.
And Brickhill, well, save Brickhill's life, of course.
Yeah, well, that's true. We're on This Week in History on Nightlife, and we're talking about something you may have heard about, the Great Escape, the breakout from the prisoner of war camp, March 24th, 1944. All right, so they dug through the cement under the stove. How did they cover that up in the day, though?
They put the stove back on top, and the stove continued to be used. So it was hot. So they used pieces of wood either side from beds, and lifted it off. Some of the things you see in the Great Escape movie were authentic, and that was one of them.
Because they did do it under the stove in there.
That's right. And of course, the Germans weren't going to go anywhere near a hot stove.
Never
occurred to them. Mm. That was a perfect cover.
Mm-hmm. All right. And you mentioned the forges. So they had teams dedicated to all the imaginable needs for the escapees, such as the forgers and the people who made the clothes.
Yep.
What were the other teams?
There was a guy, Al Hake, an Australian, who was a good friend of Paul Brickhill's. They were in Hut 103. The tunnel was going from the hut next door, Hut 104. And Al Hake was given the job of creating 200 miniature compasses, and which he did. There was another guy, another Australian, Johnny Williams. He was chief scrounger. He played the part that the guy in the movie, I can't remember his name, but he played an Australian with a dreadful Australian accent.
Oh, that was shocking. Yeah.
Why couldn't they get an Australian actor?
Well, they never can.
Peter Finch was in the Wooden Horse movie, by the way. He played an Australian. It's a minor role.
Yeah.
Anyway, his title was chief scrounger, and so he would pinch stuff from the Germans or from anywhere in the camp which they could use in their various activities. But there were some things they couldn't manufacture or purloin, and so they decided to bribe some of the weaker ferrets. The two chief ferrets, there's no way that they could be got at, but some of the others, they would, and again in the movie you see this quite well, one of the guards is taken in and they give him chocolate and all this from their Red Cross packages and so on. But there are several others who are very sympathetic to the escape. There's one German guard, I didn't tell him you know, were going to escape. But he obviously knew what they were about. He probably thought they were going to be caught anyway, so what's the difference? And he was clearly an anti-Nazi because he wrote to his girlfriend in Hamburg and asked her to send him a copy of a particular travel document which the escape organisation needed. And she did, and he passed it on to them.
So he was assisting?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, he's, without any payment. But others were bribed once they'd taken stuff, their handlers would say, okay, if you don't get this thing for me, we're going to tell your bosses that you've been taking taking chocolate and coffee.
Had them over a barrel.
Because the Germans didn't have chocolate by this point. You know, they had ersatz chocolate and ersatz coffee. It was horrible.
Mm.
So they
couldn't have done it without that help, really, could they?
And the key thing was a camera. So they got one of these bribed guards to smuggle in a camera to them, a small camera. And if you look in my book, my biography of Paul Brickhill, The Hero Maker, you'll see in the photographic section, among other things, a photograph of the men from Brickhill's hut, including himself, a month after the escape. Where did the camera come for them to be taken? This is in the camp. And, of course, it was that camera. So they retained this camera right to the end of the
war. And was that for the forgeries of the passports?
Exactly,
because
they had to
documents.
Had to put the mugshots, as they call them, and the photographs of the
incredible
people's faces.
Incredible ingenuity.
Oh, incredible. And very talented. And the guy in that charge of that department had run a graphic arts business in London before the war.
They're really using their talents. Stephen Dando Collins is our guest on Nightlife. And yes, his book is called The Hero Maker, a biography of Paul Brickhill, who was the Aussie who unfortunately had claustrophobia, but probably fortunately because he lived to tell the tale. All right. So the Tom Tunnel was discovered.
Yep.
Dick, they had to stop because it was coming up where they were building something else. And Harry was the important tunnel.
Yep.
And you mentioned the people that would go through them. Now, the Great Escape would let us believe that, you know, there were lots of Americans and they were all incredibly good looking like Steve McQueen.
Yep.
But the Americans weren't really that involved.
They were in the early stages. In fact, a guy called Jerry Sage and a couple of others, Bill Ash, were very much involved in the escape attempts from Stella Gluff 3 in the early stages. But the Germans, their security officer, he got wind of something was up. And that's after, particularly after they discovered Tom. And so they transferred 19 men who they felt were probably involved in leading escape attempts. And there were five or six in that group who were genuinely involved in the Great Escape. One was Wally Floody, the Canadian, the engineer. And a couple of Americans were moved out as well. So in the early stages, Americans were very much involved. But by the time of the final escape, the Americans had their own compound and were trying to think up their own escape attempts and dig their own tunnels at Stella Gluff 3. They were there, but not involved in the final stages of this particular escape.
And how long did it take them to dig all those metres of Harry?
Okay, so they nearly finished by Christmas of 1943. But, of course, it's bitter winter. And in Silesia in winter, the ground literally freezes.
Yeah.
And they couldn't literally dig anymore. Plus, you're not going to send men out in that sort of weather. So they had to wait till the spring the following year, 1944. And by March, they were ready. Even then, it was a bit too early. And several of the escapers ended up getting frostbite. It was that cold.
Mm.
And there was snow on the ground, and it was bitterly cold. But, of course, the Germans didn't think anybody would be stupid enough to try and escape in that weather. So that aspect worked to their advantage.
One thing I do really remember from the movie is them putting holes in their pocket and distributing the dirt from the tunnels around the camp as they whistled nonchalantly. Did they really do that?
That actually happened, mostly in the gardens. So they created these so-called gardens, which had the earth turned, because the soil they were digging in the early stages was very sandy, and to hide that they came up with these, they're called penguins, these bags in their pockets, but that only worked to a certain extent, and that's why they ended up using and they thought, well, we've stopped digging Dick, let's put dirt
it there.
Down there.
Yeah.
So that was really where the bulk of it went.
Mm-hmm. All right. So why did they settle on March 24th as the night of the escape? They must have been getting pretty antsy.
And it was Bushell, really. Bushell was pushing. To be honest, people won't like me saying this, or some people won't like me. He was a bit of a sociopath. He pushed other people to get what he wanted. And, you know, he threatened people with court-martial if they didn't help. And there's this myth that in King's regulations, an officer is required to escape from POW camps. Not true. It's not there at all. No officer is obligated to attempt to escape. But he really put the pressure on people to get what he wanted. And he wanted to get home.
Mm.
And he didn't care how many people he stepped over to get there.
Was he number one? Did he put himself top of the list?
He was number three, I think. No, yes, he was number three. So very near at the top of the list.
Yeah. And how carefully did they have to choose that list, and did he decide it?
Oh yeah, he was, get the call, Big X.
He was an autocrat.
He was an absolute autocrat. It wouldn't have happened without him, you know, so give him full credit for that. But the Germans warned them constantly, if you try to escape, you will be shot. And, this British sporting, sportsmanship feeling, we'll give it a go, we might have a chance of getting home. Particularly after they learned that the three guys that did the wooden horse escape, all three of them got back to Britain. And they got cards from them using false names saying, lovely here in the sun in
Britain. Did they?
Yeah.
So, and they knew who they were. The wooden horse, we should just say, was a pommel horse, wasn't it? Like a sporting horse, not a horsey, not like a...
Exactly. three men could fit underneath, and they were carried, it must have weighed a ton, carried by other men to a spot on the Appell ground, the parade ground, where they dug the tunnel, and then they covered it up. They worked down there all day, and the men were going jumpy jump, 40 volt. And volunteers, they knew what was going on. Volunteers put their hands up. And in the movie, The Wooden Horse, which came out in 1950, and really encouraged Brickhill to get his book, The Great Escape, out quickly, because it was number one movie of the year. In the movie of it, when they were casting it, one chap had actually been in the actual escape and been one of those vaulters, went to the producers and said, can I get a role? I was one of the... And they said, no, you're too weak. You look too puny. No one will believe it. Yeah. So he never actually got a role, though he'd been there.
Yeah, right. All right. Well, The Great Escape probably took over from The Wooden Horse in terms of movies. So they got their moment in history. Yeah, so they carefully chose the order of the men that they'd go in, which was important because it took a while for each man to get out through the tunnel and into the open. How long did
it took
it take?
Much longer than they thought.
Yeah.
They thought they could get 220 out between lights out and sun up. But they had to go along. The railroad that you see in the movie was correct. This little they built rails and little flat cars, and they'd roll themselves along. So that sped things up a little bit. But a lot of them were taking suitcases and briefcases amazing, to add to their cover stories.
Yes.
And of course it was bitterly cold. Several of them had about three heavy coats on and so on. So some got stuck. And then there was an air raid, a British air raid. The RAF didn't help. Started dropping bombs. And so the Germans, as they always did, cut the power, blacked out the camp. Which shouldn't have interfered with the escape, except the British had tapped into the power supply, and they actually had lighting right along the length of the tunnel. And they decided, just in case somebody blunders into the wall and brings the roof down and knocks one of the props aside, we better stop movement until the lights come back on. So it came back on. So that interrupted for an hour. And so things were slowed down considerably.
Right. And the tunnel wasn't long enough. So where did it come out?
Oh, there's the thing too. They miscalculated. So it came out about 30 foot from the forest, and that slowed things down even more.
Mm.
So the first guy digs the earth away from the top to make the final opening, puts his head up and goes, oh, my God, we've still got 30 feet to go.
So he was on the right side of the fence, but he wasn't in the woods. He was in open ground, so he could have been spotted.
And this is where the guards paraded. There were guards in the towers, but they were looking into the camp with their spotlights. But their other guards patrolled this ground outside the wire. There were three fences, by the way, not just the one you see in the movie. So outside the wire are the guards patrolling, but they not constantly, so every half hour they might go past. And this is what happened. So they had to wait for the guard to pass, and they rigged this system where they'd pull a piece of string from the woods to the exit of the tunnel, saying all clear. And so then somebody would bolt across as fast as they could, and they'd get as many out as possible and then wait for the guard to pass the next time and so on.
Oh, my gosh. And the men kept coming slower than they wanted, but they did keep coming till 5 in the morning. What happened then?
So a guard stumbled on the entrance. He'd just gone off his usual track and came across this hole. He looked at the guy.
What, in the hut where
outside the wire.
Oh, at the outside. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And he walks up and there's this hole and a man looking up at him. And he froze, and this escapee froze. And then a New Zealander at the forest, waiting to pull the string to say all was clear, he stood up to distract him so he didn't shoot him and surrendered. And then I think the guard fired in the air, and then all hell broke loose. And so all the other prisoners who were stretched the length of the tunnel back to Hut 104 panicked. Yeah, and they had to go backwards, reverse, because they worried if they were caught, they'd be shot. And so they're panicking to get back in. The Germans are panicking there's been an escape, and it just all hell broke loose. Right. And those that were still in the forest, the first men out, they were hours away. They were well gone, but there were still others in the forest, and they ran hell for leather.
All right, and so the ones that went backwards and then came back up out the hole, I imagine that, they pretty quickly, how long did it take till they... what happened to them? Were they busted?
So they're in Hut 104, but they're wearing their escape outfits. And so they're trying to get rid of all this. They start light fires on the floor, burning their documents because, in possession of fake documents. There was one dressed as a German soldier. and under the laws of war, he could be shot immediately, wearing the uniform of the other side. And so he's trying to get rid of that. And the other thing is that they all didn't belong there. And they couldn't get back to their own huts. So once they were found there, the Germans knew damn well that they were part of the plot.
Right.
So, but the Germans never found the inside for hours until a plucky German, and they turned the power off, of course, so there's no light in the tunnel. So a plucky German came in the other end from the outside and crawled all the way, and then knocked on the base of the stove and said, "Excuse me, please, will you please open for me?"
Under the stove.
Yeah, and so that's how they found the entrance.
The entrance of it, okay. And how far, so how many prisoners had got how far?
76 got out.
Yeah.
But those first, the two at the tunnel and the one at the forest were caught immediately. 74 on the run. They caught all but three. Most of them very quickly. Some went to the railway station and then missed their train and all sorts of things. And Busher was caught, you see in the movie, when he and his cohort at a bus stop and the German is speaking to them in German.
They can't speak German.
Yeah, they could. They could, but the German was a security officer and he talks to them in German and says, your papers are in order. And just as they turned to go away, he said, in English, good luck.
Oh, that's right.
And they turned around and said, thank you.
Oh, so is that real?
Yeah, real.
That was actual real that they did in the movie. Yeah, you couldn't write that stuff in a movie. Oh, that's right.
The things that aren't real were the motorbike chase.
Steve McQueen did not try and jump the fence.
No, Steve McQueen in the movie said, I'm not getting enough screen time. I love motorbikes. Give me a motorbike chase. So they made it up while they were shooting it in Bavaria. Right. Oh, the other classic irony is when they shot it on location in Bavaria and built this camp or part of a camp. Who do you think played the extras of the British airmen in the camp? German university students from Munich.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that an irony?
That's very ironic. You're on Nightlife. We're hearing the real great escape. If you've seen the film, you'll be sorting out some fact for fiction tonight, because it was on the night of March 24th, 1944, that the 76 prisoners escaped. Stephen Dando Collins is with me, author of The Hero Maker, a biography of Paul Brickhill. All right, let's hear the good news. How did the three who did manage to escape get out? Where did they go? Tell us their successful stories.
So the three who did succeed, two Norwegians and one Dutchman, and they went in the guise of forced labourers. And forced labourers were allowed to travel across Germany had appropriate papers. And, of course, they could speak the language. I'm a Norwegian. They had so they were able to get as far as France. Then they got involved with the
resistance.
Resistance. The two Norwegians got to a northern port and stowed away aboard a ship. So you see two in the movie do that. That's what happened. Except the Danny Kroll, the real Polish guy, it's Charles Bronson playing that role, and he's one of those that escapes on the ship. His parentage was actually Polish. He changed his name. Bronson wasn't his actual name. So, but the real Danny Kroll was one of those who was caught and shot. So those two got as far as Sweden, which was a neutral country, and they got back to Britain. The other guy, the Dutch guy, got involved with the French resistance, and they took him across the Pyrenees to Spain, which was neutral. The Spanish government actually were favourable towards the Nazis, but they were able to get this guy to the British embassy, and they got him home. So that was the Dutch guy.
Right. Okay. Well, those three must have, been thrilled, but then devastated to learn that 50 of the escapees were shot by the Gestapo. So what were the circumstances in which they did that? Because the Geneva Convention states that prisoners should not be executed for trying to escape.
So they had been warned for 2 years, and 73 were caught, three got home, and Hitler was furious. And he called a conference with Goering, the head of the Luftwaffe. The camp guards, by the way, were Luftwaffe, with our Air Force. It was felt that Air Force men should look after Air Force men.
Right.
Hitler said, shoot a lot of them. And Goering said, you can't do that, you can't do that. And he argued against it and finally got him to agree to do 50. He said one of the reasons he argued against it was they'll shoot our men in Britain, in the British camps. Mm. And so 50 were chosen by a general called Arthur Nebe. He later was involved in the plot against Hitler and was executed by the SS. But he chose the 50 at random. There's no real reason why those that were chosen were chosen. But anyway, so in the movie, you see them being mowed down by a machine gun after they've been let out of the bed of a truck. That didn't happen. They were interrogated. They were told they were being sent back to the Stalag Luft 3 in groups of one and two. And then in a forest on the drive back, you can get out now and relieve yourself because it's a long drive. And then as they got their pants down, literally, or just standing talking,
they shot them.
Came up behind them with a pistol and shot them in the back of the head.
Oh, such bravery.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So that was a definite violation. Were any of the other Gestapo members prosecuted later on?
So this got back to Britain, the news that 50 had been executed, through the agency of a guy called Group Captain Doug Wilson, an Australian. The senior British officer in the camp was Group Captain Massey through the escape. A month after the escape, he had a serious leg wound and the Germans allowed him to be repatriated to Britain and he was replaced by Doug Wilson and the Australian. And when the officers from the what was called the Protecting Power, they're from Sweden, came through the camp as they did on occasions to inspect and make sure everything was above board, he was able to palm a list of the names of all the men that they'd been told had been executed, and the Swedes passed this on to the British government, and so Anthony Eden, the Foreign Minister, stood up in the House of Commons on June 23, I think it was, 1944, and said this has been a violation of the Geneva Convention. 50 of them officers have been shot by the Germans. And so after the war, and Paul Brickhill got well into this, and in his book, The Great Escape, he details what the British did to try and track down the men involved, the Gestapo and others, who'd either ordered or even driven the cars for the men that were shot, or those that physically took part in it. And quite a few were found, arrested, several were executed, several got long sentences. As late as 1968, one of them was tracked down in Germany. But by that stage, the German government was trying to put the war behind them and they didn't want to make a big deal of it. So he got a minor sentence, I think.
Right.
And they just wanted to, paper over it.
Mm, okay. Well, it must have been highly embarrassing for Hitler and humiliating. You can see why Psycho reacted
the way he did. And it worked. It worked because...
What, it stopped all other escapes?
It stopped all other escapes.
Yeah.
The order that the senior Allied officers in all the camps were called in and said, these have been shot. If it happens, any more escape, they will be shot. And they knew they meant it. And so the senior British officers then called their escape committees in and said, you will stop all escape attempts from this moment forward. And they weren't popular, of course. Back at Shuben, the camp I mentioned earlier, at where the initial ex-organisation had been created, it was now an American camp full of American officers. And they were still there in January 1945 when the Russians were approaching. And they'd never been told that the British had dug tunnels beneath their camp, and they started digging their own tunnels. With the Russians getting closer, they were, within a few days, the Germans said, we're going to march you west away from the Russians. Some Americans hid in the unfinished tunnels, which had stopped as soon as this order had come through. All escape attempts will cease. And others escaped on the march. 250 Americans escaped from the Germans into the hands, they went east into the hands of the Russians. All of them got home. So that was by far the most successful. This was the real great escape of the war.
When was that? 1945?
January 1945.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that was another great escape.
It was. Which I've written about as well in a book called The Big Break.
That's your second book, The Big Break.
Yeah.
And let's go back to Stalag Luft 3. What happened on D-Day to those prisoners? So there 23, were they put back into that camp?
Okay,
the other 23?
So several were were allowed back into the camp, but others who were considered serial escapees were sent to concentration camps. But they all survived.
They all survived. The other 23.
Yeah, and, okay. And in one concentration camp, they successfully escaped again. And were caught.
You just can't keep a good man down, yeah, can
but,
you?
But this was right at the end of the war, and the Germans didn't shoot them. They knew that the German officer who caught them knew that the game was up, and they knew that they were going to face punishment. Yeah. So they kept them alive.
So and to you, for you, the film The Great Escape, which is the biggest liberties they take? Is it about them making American heroes so they can get that American audience?
And I don't blame them for doing that. And of course, that did get an American audience, and Steve McQueen was brilliant. Mm. And I was a huge fan of Steve McQueen.
Yes, so, me too.
So I had... he died way too young. So I had no real problem with that. Brick Hill was lambasted by... He was actually excluded from the fraternity of the Stalag Luft III escapees.
Why?
They were jealous when he wrote the book, and it became the biggest selling book in British history.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he outdid it later with the Dambusters, and then even bigger sales with Reach for the Sky, the Douglas Bader story. Mm. No, they excluded him from his ranks because he profited from it.
Mm.
Now, many others also wrote books about it, following his example, but of course they didn't do it anywhere near as well. God, he was a really clever writer. He was a trained journalist, and he went to the core of the guts of the story, as he called it. But then when the movie came out, they really gave him heaps because he'd allowed the producers, the American producers, to make heroes of the Americans. So he was a very troubled man toward the end of his life. They blamed him for that. But if it weren't for Brick Hill writing the book, He wrote it four times, you know, the story. He wrote it as a radio talk, which he gave it on the BBC in 1945. Then he wrote it in a book called Escape to Danger. It was the last third of the book. It was a version of the story. And then he wrote newspaper articles with which the British press refused to print because he was only an Australian. So he got it printed in Australia. And then, as I mentioned earlier, when The Wooden Horse was about to come out, his British publisher said, look, we need a new book from you. Why don't you expand on that story you wrote in Escape to Danger about the escape from Stalag Luft III? And they came up with the title, The Great Escape, his editor.
Oh.
Based on that, Brick Hill had come back to Australia, got on a ship and went back to England and agreed to write the story of the Dambusters, and very, very quickly wrote the story to get it out in time so that it was out when the movie, The Wooden Horse, came out, and to capitalise on that.
Right. And the book, The Great Escape, has never been published in Poland, where it took place. Yeah. I mean, I know you said it was Germany, but it's Poland now.
Yeah, ever since the war it's been Poland. And I was contacted by a Polish publisher last year who told me this, which is ironic because a number of my books are published in Poland. There you go. And he said, can you help me? He'd read my book, The Hero Maker, and he said, we'd like to publish that. But first, we want to get people to know who Paul Brickhill is. Mm. And we'd love to do The Great Escape. Can you put me in touch with someone who will give us permission? Well, fortunately, I knew that Paul's literary estate is managed by a particular literary agency in London, and I put the two together. So hopefully it will happen now.
The Great Escape will finally be told in the country.
Yeah, where it happened.
Where it happened. All right. Well, I'm glad that Paul did tell the story. I'm sorry he was ostracised by the others, but it's made a heck of a tale. And it's such a important story of ingenuity and bravery and gumption and guts, isn't it?
And luck and just an amazing story.
Mm, yeah. And thank you so much for telling it to us tonight on Nightlife.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Good on you, Stephen. Stephen Dando Collins, author of The Hero Maker, a biography of Paul Brickhill and several other books.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.